In blades, more offset actually keeps the ball flight down.
In blades, more offset keeps it down.
Ball flight down because the hands are ahead and they lead this way. Stop trying to be uncomfortable. If you're uncomfortable, you should never pull that club. You can play golf. You can score. It's not rocket science. It's like, hey, let's do it repetitive.
There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out, is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rip it.
Mr. Larry Bobka, welcome to the studio. I said Mr. Larry Bobka, welcome to the studio.
It's nice to be here.
You're going to have to hold that so people can hear you. You're going to be okay doing that? You can lean back if you want. Sometimes I do this.
Sometimes, is this good?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
You can hear me now?
Yeah.
That's too much work. I'm going to get closer to it.
See, you guys are so advanced at Second Swing. You got like the little mics right here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't upgraded yet.
Is that better now?
Yeah, you're perfect.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. We need the audience to be able to hear the legend of Larry Bobka.
They don't want to hear. They don't need to hear it.
See, that's not true. You've been on before, but I went back and listened. One thing I did not do a good job of is asking you about your story and how like you got up to this point. We kind of like jumped into Second Swing and where things are at today. And I know there's a long history of what has brought you here. Cause how long have you been in the industry now?
Well, if you go back to when I started working at golf courses, this will be 52 years this year.
Wow. And you just said, you're turning 66. So you've been working on the golf course since you were 14. Give or take 13, 14 years old. Yeah. It's a long time.
And no other business other than that.
Yeah, other than golf. So you're a wealth of knowledge that we get to tap into today. Yeah,
couple days.
Well, let's talk about it then. Obviously, want to hear what has brought you to Second Swing and doing what you're doing today. But I've got what I would imagine is going to be plenty of stories along the way from working with Tiger and all the different companies you've worked for. So where did it start? It was Chicago, right? Is that where you were born?
Grew up in northwest suburbs of Chicago. Started repairing golf clubs at around 14 or 15 years old. The golf course I grew up at was semi-private, great owners. Still talk to one of the owners to this day. He's still alive. And it was a situation where I was like, well, hell, if you're going to hang around the golf course all the time, you might as well just work too. So started being the cart boy in the mornings on Saturday and Sunday, and then the afternoon starter. Well, if you've ever been an afternoon starter at a busy public golf course, it's trial by fire.
Sure, I can imagine.
Especially when the owners come out and say, hey, these people just showed up. They want to get in. Can you slip them in and,
make it work.
Yeah. But the other good part about that was there was a green, there was a putting green and a bunker right next to it. So when I wasn't that busy, I had my sand wedge and my putter with me all the time. So hit a bunch of wedges and putting, and so it was fun. It was a great upbringing. It was a lot of fun. I worked there every summer, and played high school golf. And then played college golf at Northeastern Illinois University because it was the only place that would let me in with my grades. They were not stellar, to say the least. But I always knew there was going to be a life in golf. I didn't know how. I didn't know what. Thought I was going to take kind of the club pro route. So played in college and left school. I'd like to say graduated, but you actually have to go to class to graduate. So that was not my favorite thing to do. And tried to play for a living, played a couple winters down on Space Coast Mini Tours. Back then there was no Corn Ferry or anything. So you either played the Space Coast in Orlando or you played the Golden State tour out in California.
So yeah, because what year would this be? Would this be the, is my math right, in about the 70s?
81.
80s, okay. Yeah, so early 80s.
Yeah, back in the dark ages with Persimmon and Bellotta. So, you know, there was not a lot of game improvement golf clubs back then.
How many were those the two manufacturers? I know nothing pre-2010.
Manufacturers were pretty much, you had Wilson, you had Spalding, you had McGregor. Titleist was more golf. At that time, Titleist was more golf ball than they were clubs. You know, they bought Golfcraft, which was an older company. They bought Golfcraft night in 68, but they didn't really do much in golf equipment then. Let's see, who am I missing? Northwestern, which was the low-end store line clubs. But my uncle was the production manager for Northwestern Golf Clubs and lived next door. So my mom used to paint iron heads and putters in our garage for him. He'd bring them home, and my aunt and my mom would just sit there and paint putters.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So it was fun. It was a fun upbringing.
That is awesome. So let's see, early 80s, and then what happens when you get into the 90s after college? And I want to ask, too, like, what was repairing clubs back then like? It's got to be completely different than what it is today.
That was Persimmon Woods. You're fixing, you're refinishing woods. You're trying to fix the faces where somebody can't hit the center of the face. And it was a lot different.
Yeah, like actual work, right? Yeah. Not like where you can just, take a wrench and kind of tweak things or just go grab a new head out of a drawer.
Well, yeah, and most companies had, the iron heads were pinned because epoxies weren't as good back then as they are now. So everybody worried about their heads flying off. So they would pin them. So you got to knock the pins out. You got to get them out. Yeah, it was a lot more work than it was. But, my dad said, hey, you're either going to have to stop throwing clubs or you're going to have to learn how to fix them. Because I'm tired to pay for the repairs. And I chose to learn how to fix them.
Yeah. And so how did you get this, I'll call it, reputation of like being that guy? Because I remember I went back and looked, and it was probably maybe in the 90s or early 2000s, is that when you kind of were doing stuff with Tiger and actually building clubs as well?
Well, yeah. If you go back to the Wilson days, so 1984, I was an assistant pro, and I was actually in line because the owner of the club that I worked at was gonna fire the head pro and make me the head professional. And just about that time, Wilson came along because I had had lunch. So my dad's drinking buddies were Bob Mandrella, who was, arguably one of the best iron designers ever, Joe Phillips, who was the tour promotion guy for Wilson, and Bob Lampkin of Lampkin Grips.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his little.
I've been a customer for a while.
Yeah, yeah, a little drink. Yeah, so that, so then I went to lunch one day, and I had these clubs. I had these four Titleist laminated woods that it was one of my dad's buddies. And, I mean, this guy looked like he had literally just taken a hammer and pounded on them, and they were just awful. I mean, they just. Think about the worst golf swing with a wood, and you can just freaking destroy it. So I fixed them. I brought them to him, and Joe Phillips happened to be there, and he goes, where'd you do this stuff? I go, well, I did it at my parents' garage. He goes, you repaired those clubs in your parents' garage? And I said, yeah. He goes, what kind of machinery do you have? And I'm like, showed him my hands, and I said, these. He goes, we need to talk. So I ended up becoming the liaison between Wilson tour players and the Wilson engineers that were designing clubs. Mm,
got it.
Because they were having trouble communicating together. And so Joe brought me out there, and so I started doing that, started learning how to grind irons and I knew how to repair woods. I didn't know how to build them from scratch. So I learned how to do that. And about a year later, they're like, hey, we need a line of persimmon woods. Can you design it for us? Like, okay.
I'll try.
I've never done this before. He goes, well, you know enough about shapes. You've seen enough things. You know, you're kind of into all these old McGregors that, you know, that the players were playing, the M85s and the 693s. Yeah. And you know the shapes. So so I designed a set, and I had gotten help from, and you might not even know the name, Tony Penna. Tony mm-hmm. Penna designed all the great Tommy Armour woods for McGregor in the late 40s, 50s, and early 60s. Tony Penna was a player and also a club designer. So one day I was like in there working on this line, and all of a sudden Joe shows up with this little Italian guy, and he's like, Larry, this is Tony Penna. I'm like, I mean, this is kind of one of my idols, right?
Yeah.
So he spent a week with me, and every day we, you know, we were routing sole plates and putting inserts in and, you know, picking blocks and doing all the stuff you need to do to make a great persimmon wood. And, you know, I'm telling you, for 4 days, I was the worst club maker on the planet. So finally we got the driver 3-wood and 4-wood done. We had put it, you know, put stain on it, finished it, whatever, you know. Mr. Penna puts it down, and he goes, if you pay attention, he goes, you can probably be somebody in this industry. I'm like, Mr. Penna, for the last 4 days, I was the worst club maker ever. He goes, if I told you on day one that you had some talent, would you have listened to me as much as you did? I'm like, probably not. Good thought. Yeah. Good thought there. Yeah. So he was the first guy, I mean, between Joe Phillips and Bob Mandrella and Tony Penna, those were the first guys that are like, hey, you got some talent. You know what a golf club looks like. You care about repairing it. You care about building it. And so then I went on to design, you know, System 45 Ultra Irons, Ultra Metal Woods, the Whale Driver that Payne won the PGA and the U.S. Open at Hazeltine with. That was my design. So now all of a sudden it's like, holy cow, I'm like designing 75% of all the Titleist or the Wilson product. And so then in 1991, a good friend of mine was starting UST. He's like, hey, I need a vice president of R&D. And this was Larry Bodle who worked for True Temper. And I'm like, Larry, I don't have a degree. I'm not an engineer. And he goes, yeah, he goes, you're way better than engineer. He goes, you can talk to people. I'm like, okay, let's do that. So I worked for them for 5 years. And then in 1995, I was giving a speech at a golf writers convention about golf shafts. And Wally Uline, the president and CEO of Titleist, was also speaking. He was the keynote speaker. And after that, he came up to me and said, hey, really enjoyed your speech. And oh, by the way, I'm going to go, because back then all they were really making was DCIs, and they were all cast clubs. He goes, I want to go from cast clubs to forged clubs, and I need somebody who knows how to do that and can talk to players, and because I'm going to sign these guys, and they're all going to need forgings. And I'm like, all right. And
figure it out.
Yeah, and they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and moved my family from Dallas to Carlsbad, and, you know, then that was 95. So then, you know, the crazy 19 years at Titleist started.
Yeah, you spent 19 years there?
Spent 19 years there.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yep.
The I was looking at a post the other day. It shows, all the winners from the Masters for the last, call it, 20 years.
Right.
And it showed the putters, irons, and drivers. So not the woods, not the wedges, but putters, irons, drivers. And the thing that stood out to me the most was how much the look of like putters and drivers have changed.
Yeah.
But irons looked practically the same, aside from, you know, like the logo, right, that you would see on it. Right. And I've been waiting to ask this question to kind of understand, because like I hear you reference Persimmon Woods and like spending all the time on the, you know, the three wood and the top of the bag, but like irons seem to not change that much. And I'm very curious why. Is it a technology thing? Is it a, they've just cracked the code in terms of, you know, what they're going to look like in its very small minor tweaks, or what is it?
Well, if you look at forged irons, I mean, if you're looking at a forged blade, there's only so much you can do. Like Tiger's TaylorMade irons, they put a 20-gram slug right in the middle behind the area of impact. And, you know, he says it feels more solid. Other companies have done that. But if you go back and you really think about it, I mean, if I'm doing a forged iron, there's not a hell of a lot you can do with it, because you got a weight problem. So that kind of limits the size. Now, cast clubs, okay, let's go to 17-4. Let's go to Ping I2s, okay? Karsten comes out and goes, I'm going to cast these things, and I can put cavities, and I can do all these things, okay? And people have played. They've won majors with Pings, okay? Ping I2s, arguably one of the best iron design ever. But now you go back, and if you're going to, you know, like yourself, somebody who likes to play, okay, I want to look at it. I don't want a heck of a lot of offset. I don't want a big blade. You know, this is the look I want to look. We're strapped for what you can do.
What you can and can't right? do.
You know, you don't want to see a big, you don't want to see a big chunk behind it.
Yeah.
You know, there's been clubs that have been made that way that all of a sudden you put it down and you're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to look at that. It looks like a hybrid. You know, this looks terrible. So you're kind of limited by the ability of the material, the ability of the construction to really do anything that amazing with a, quote, good player's iron.
Yeah. So like the, you know, I'll call them custom, but, you know, like the pros custom irons, what are the things that they're actually changing? Is it really just all look and then kind of like wait for feel depending on where their, you know, strike location is?
Well, see, back in the day, and you don't get a lot of players doing it anymore, but, you know, we started with raw forgings back at Wilson. So you could change the offset, you could change the loft, you could change the look on the toe. You could do a lot of things to it because, you know, Bob Mandrella, myself, there was a guy by the name of Frank who was a great iron grinder, and players would come in and you just sit in front of the wheel and grind it how they wanted it to look, you know, take bounce off, add bounce, you know, what do you want to do? I mean, it's kind of like Tiger's original set. You know, we went with two different sets of forgings because his long irons, he wanted more bounce. So I had to go to a different club. But in the meantime, I'm manipulating the look of the club, the hosel, because I have the ability and I know how to use a hammer and a lead block and know how to take offset out, put offset in. You know, that's just that's an old school art that is, you know, fading away.
Why is it fading away? Is it fading away because so many guys change and tweak so often, or is it just due to, you know, manufacturing and how many clubs they have to build that
the craftsmen are dying?
Oh, and interesting.
The craftsmen are dying away, and the companies also don't want to spend the time. So, like, you know, if I was, you know, during the Titleist years, okay, you're doing a set of irons, okay, you're doing like say the 690 MBs. So you try to take and try to put as many things in that golf club that say, if I got 12 guys that are going to play this club, let me get a design that's going to take care of 8 of those guys. And then the 4 guys are the flyers that we're going to bring some raw forgings in, and I'm going to have to do some manipulating of that golf club. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you go to National Custom. You know, they got Don White, who arguably maybe the best grinder of golf clubs ever. You know, he knows how to do all that stuff. You know, Jordan Hagel wants a 4 iron that's got the loft of the 3 iron, but doesn't want offset. Well, how are you going to do that? Well, I got to take a raw forging, and I got to hammer that thing into submission, so it doesn't have, because if I bend it strong, it immediately puts offset in it.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, yeah. I've done a couple things for my good friend Jason at Sub 70. You know, he sent me a set of wedges, and he's like, "Hey," he goes, "John Daly wants to play our wedges, but they have too much offset in it." I said, "Well, send me the heads. Send me a 50, 54, and a 60, and sent them, got them, took about 12 minutes with a hammer over there at Minnetonka, and sent them back to him. And he's like, "How did you do that?"
I'm like, "Hammer."
I'm like, "Well, that's part of the reason that I have no shoulder left." But, you know, you know that, but that's how I learned,
yeah.
You know, and that's how the old school guys learned. It wasn't sitting on a CAD cam. I mean, you would physically make a design of heads from maybe another set of heads, Bondo, do all this stuff, make them look right, and then get them forged. But then somebody would look at it and go, "Boy, that's really nice, but can you take some offset out of those?" Okay. Well, you got a raw set of heads over here. I'll pound the offset out. Or, you know, Bernhard Langer's case. "Hey, I want more offset.
He plays more offset. Yeah, that's pretty rare.
I want him and Nick Price. Okay. Because in blades, more offset actually keeps the ball flight down.
In blades, more offset keeps it down.
Ball flight down because the hands are ahead and they lead this way.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in game improvement clubs, because the offset puts the center of gravity back and the center of gravity is much lower, it actually makes the ball go up in the air. So it's kind of like everybody says, "Well, offset makes that go high." No. The design of the head makes it go high.
Sure.
Yeah.
Huh. That is something I've quite literally never heard. Now I'm like thinking of it in my brain. So yeah, I mean, game improvement irons are, you know, made to help people get the ball in the air. So I guess it makes sense. They put a different center of gravity.
Well, if you look, some of the old Mizuno irons, some of the old Bridgestone irons, they all have reverse offset. They have very little offset in the long irons, and they have a lot of offset in the short irons. And everybody looks at them and goes, "Well, that's weird." No, because it's in an effort to get your hands forward and flight it down. I mean, they had it. It's just everybody looks at it and goes, "Oh, I can't play a set of clubs like that. That looks weird." But, you know, if you're playing the right golf club, a little bit of offset's never going to hurt you.
Yeah. What about, so now, like, you take away the irons and you start moving into the drivers and woods of today compared to the ones that you used to look at, right? Like that was the biggest thing that I noticed aside from the irons, is how different drivers look, and like what the face material and this, you know, new chase for speed, right? It looks completely different. Like literally you look at the drivers of today compared to the ones even 15 years ago, it's like they look like spaceships, right? Like they look like this new modern cool thing. What's your take on just like the need for speed with today? Is there a point of diminishing return with these guys? And like now we've got the rollback coming. Is it all just for show, or like what's going on with the need for speed?
Well, there's always been a need for speed. There's always been, hey, let's put, even when there was Woodwoods, hey, can we put a different insert? Can we put an aluminum insert? Can we put, you know, there was this green fiber stuff called Gamma Fire that you could barely even cut a score line in because it was so hard. But, hey, this is going to make my persimmon wood go 10 yards further. It's always been there, okay? It's been there since golf has always been around.
Yeah.
People have always wanted to hit it farther. The thing about it is the USGA allowed the size of the driver and the speed off the face to get faster, you know, then it's kind of multiplied. And you have to remember, you know, my generation grew up playing golf clubs that were small. You had to hit it on the insert, because if you didn't hit it on the insert, you're looking for the club repair guy because you're breaking wood chips
off
the heel and the toe. Yeah, it's not surviving that. So, you know, and the clubs were shorter and they were heavier. I mean, because, you know, back in the day when I started playing golf, you know, you're playing in high school and it's like, okay, well, I either have, what's your shaft choices? That would be regular stiff or extra stiff.
Weren't really weights.
No, there was no weight shafts till about the early 80s. True Temper started to come out with they called the shaft the extra light. And I think it was, you know, it went down from 130 to like 105, you know.
Oh, so they just used to all be 130.
Oh, yeah. They used to all be heavy.
Interesting.
Yeah. So now there's a chase for that. So, I mean, your generation, I mean, you know, you didn't grow up on persimmon wood. You never saw a steel shaft in a metal, right, in your driver or three wood. So now all of a sudden it's like you're growing up with all this lighter, faster equipment, you know, and it's easier to play. I mean, I still go out and hit my persimmon. I got two storage units full of clubs that my wife would love for me to get rid of. So, you know, so now you're sitting there and you're going, okay, well, hey, now I've got this longer, lighter club, and it's easier to create club head speed. Now you got somebody your age that is talented, works on their strength, works on their flexibility, and it can hit a ball a long way. You know, the problem that we have now is you've got players hitting it so far that, you know, if you drive at 320 on a 460-yard hole, pretty much hitting a wedge, right? You're hitting your pitching wedge. If you can hit it 320, you're hitting your pitching wedge, maybe a 9-iron. So what's happening is, especially for the strong players, is, geez, I got my driver going so far. Now my irons go so far. I mean, most players carry 4 wedges. I mean, it's probably getting to be the time to play 5 wedges.
Really?
Yeah, because what are you going to do with all those other clubs in the bag? I mean, think about it.
Yeah, how often do you hit a 4 and 5 iron, basically?
So, think about it. So, if you drive at 320 and you hit your pitching wedge 140, that's 180 yards.
Okay? Yep.
This is about all the math I got, Jordan. So
I'll keep you on track.
So, that's 180 yards. Well, if I'm at 140 to zero, that's 140 yards. How many clubs do you have in that 180 yards? You got about 8, 9 clubs there. You got about eight, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four.
Your 2 woods and your driver. I think that's 9 clubs.
It's 9 clubs.
Yeah.
From 140 yards in, what do you got? You got 3.
Yeah. 3 wedges, pitching wedge.
3 wedges and a pitching wedge.
Yeah.
And most of your shots are being played from 140 yards in.
But then, so how about so I agree, but I hear, I especially hear pros all the time say, like, you shouldn't be full swinging with wedges, right? So like if you wouldn't want a 90, 100, 110, 120 and 130 yard club, would you? Or would you? I'm just curious.
But think about it this way. If you're going at 140, now you're looking at going, hey, maybe I should have my pitching wedge go 140, you know, and then I've got a club at 125. I got a club at 110, I got a club at 95, and I got a club at 80. And the other part of that, too, is I can also change the grind, change the bounce to make my wedge play work better, you know?
Yeah.
And you sit there and go, okay, well, I got a 4-iron in the bag. How many times do I hit my 4-iron? You know, maybe you hit your 4-iron once every 3 rounds, once every 5 rounds of golf. Well, just take your 5-iron and strengthen the loft a little bit and take your 4-iron out and add a wedge. I mean, that's what Tom Kite did. Tom Kite, you know, originally was the guy that really started 60-degree wedges. So what he did was he had a driver, a 3-wood, and a 4-wood, and then he had a traditional set of clubs. You know, he had 2 through a sand wedge. And he decided that, hey, I really need another wedge. I'm not scoring well enough. So I'm gonna add a higher lofted wedge. I'm gonna add a 60 or 62 degree wedge that's shorter that I can kind of full swing from about 70 yards and become better on the par fives because I don't hit it far enough to get to the par fives that other guys do.
Yeah.
So what he did was his 3-iron was actually a 2-iron head that was ground heavy enough to match his 3-iron length. So his lofts went, and this is old school lofts. So now his 3-iron/2-iron is 20 degrees. Then his 4-iron is 25. Then his 5-iron is 30. And his, oh, and his 6-iron is 35. So he just spread it out a little bit going, hey, I don't really miss anything by doing this. And I've got this club here that is going to help me win golf tournaments. And it
interesting.
Did. Yeah. So that, you know, kind of gapping the bag has been around for a long time. It's just, it was done differently back then, you know?
Well, and it seems like gapping has changed in the last 2 years now, with the introduction of the mini driver as well. And myself, and I feel like a lot of others are starting to have two setups where you'll have a traditional like driver, you know, 3 or 4 wood, and then like 7 wood or 5 wood, and then you go into your irons. And other setups where you may have a driver, mini driver, 5 wood go into your irons. And then some people, especially out at Windsong, a lot of guys will, you know, swap out a wood for like a driving iron for those days, right, when it's super windy. But for, you know, the call it everyday casual golfer, what are you fitting most people into for their traditional bag? Is it still driver, 3 wood, some type of like, you know, 7 wood or more forgiving, and then into irons? Or,
well, it's more into, for the average player, depending on the speed and their launch condition, is probably closer to driver, 5 wood, 9 wood.
Just and, to get some help to get the ball in the air.
Okay. So, you know, I've had back surgery 5 months ago. I've started back playing again. Almost 66 years old, so there's not a lot of speed anymore. I mean, I can hit it straight. I can find it every time. There's good ball flight, but the ball doesn't go anywhere anymore. So now all of a sudden, if I drive at 230 and I'm down to zero, you know, it's not like you that are driving. You got to cover 320 to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've got different needs than you do.
Sure.
Okay. So I've got a driver, right? Then I've got a 15 degree 3 wood that's lofted up to 17. So essentially it's a 4 wood. Okay. And then I have a 9 wood that is de-lofted to basically a 7 wood. So now I have driver, 4 wood, 7 wood. Then it's like I have an old Adams 5 hybrid that, you know, they'll probably put in my grave because I will not get rid of this club because I hit it. But that's my 4-iron now. Okay.
Yeah.
That plays like my 4-iron. And then I have, you know, I make my own irons. So then I have 5 through pitching wedge. And then I have a 52 and a 58. And I've played 52 and 58 for a long time.
And so your 52 and 58 cover 100 and in, or like 80 and in? Or what is it?
My pitching wedge, my 52 and 58 cover 100 in, because there is...
Pitching wedge 52, 58. Yeah. Covers, yeah. So you have 3 wedges that cover 100
in. 100 and in.
Yeah.
Because I don't hit it that far anymore.
Yeah. Well, I'm more so asking not necessarily from the distance perspective, right, but more for like how many wedges, in your opinion, is the right number of wedges to cover 100 in? Because I feel like for me, it's probably one of my weaknesses is... I use like 1 wedge from 100 and in, and I probably shouldn't. I'm trying to get better at using my 54 is like 110.
Yeah.
And then if it's less than that, I'll either full swing a 58, or like I'm using that on a 40 yard pitch shot to a 80 yard pitch shot to greenside. And, you know, some days I like that, 'cause it's like, I'm getting really good with one club.
Right.
Other days I'm like, man, I should probably have more shots in my bag. You know, and so that's why I'm asking.
You'd be the perfect guy to mess around with a 62, because now you can full swing. And you got to remember, the modern golf ball needs to be hit full. Okay. Half shots with a modern golf ball aren't like half shots with a Bellotta golf ball. back in the day, it stayed on the face longer and it retained its spin more. Mm. You really have to hit a modern golf ball with a little bit of compression and a little bit of spin to get control of it. So that's why it makes more sense to go, okay, well, I'm going to add, past my 58, I'm going to add a 62, and I can stand there, and maybe my 62 only goes, you know, 80 yards.
Yeah.
But I can full swing at 80 yards, and oh, by the way, if I need a 60-yarder, that's way less taking off your 58 than it is any other club. So
It might not be a terrible idea, because I really don't hit my 4-iron very often. But then I would just feel like I have a massive gap between 5-iron and 5-wood. But how often do I have 220, including on a lock, because I'm not hitting 4-iron?
Right. And then you just put you – I mean, it's easy. You can always, you know, you always hit a little draw with the 5-iron, or just choke down the 5-wood.
Give me too much credit.
Well, no, but think about it. How many times does that happen?
Yeah, not super often.
You know, needing a 62-degree wedge could happen every hole.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, you know, no, I agree.
It could literally happen on every hole. So if you sit there, I mean, Dave Pelz wrote a great book called The Short Game Bible. And if you read it and you go through it, he took a bunch of tour players and he made them take, you know, it was back in the day where guys carried 2 irons and whatever. He made them take all the even number irons out of their bag. And they only played with 10 clubs.
Is the pitching wedge considered an even?
No, the pitching wedge stayed okay.
So it's 8, 6, 4.
They took 2, 4, 6, and 8 out of their bag. And most of the 99% of the guys came back and said, we scored just as good or better.
Yeah.
Because how many times are you going to hit a full 4-iron and hit the green?
Yeah, not very often.
Not very often. Oh, I need my 62-degree wedge to get me out of trouble.
Out of the bunker, right? Out of the shit.
You know, especially, you know, you play Windsong. It's not, you know, those are not the easiest bunkers to play out of.
Yeah.
You know, you can get yourself in some trouble where, hey, 4 degrees aloft is going to help me a lot.
Hmm.
So.
Well, maybe you'll be seeing me next week. I mean, you normally would, but.
Yeah, but no, it's something to think about, and it's something to play around with, because if you're really trying to save shots, wedges and putters are going to help you way more than a driver or a 3-wood or a 5-wood.
Yeah.
You know, and hey, I work for Second Swing. We sell golf equipment, but I want you, and I want everybody who comes in the bay to play better golf, you know. And if that means, hey, you know, you really want a 3-wood, Mr. Smith, but by the way, I think you'd be far better off, because I can't tell you the people that come in and go, hey, I want a new set of irons. Okay, how's your wedge play? It's not very good. It's not very good. I mean, 70% of shots are played from 60 yards and in.
Yeah. People just don't, I mean.
They don't know.
Yeah.
They don't know what they don't know.
Or you track it. I mean, coincidentally, the worst part of my game right now is my iron play, but it has more to do with proximity to the hole, not necessarily, right. You know, chunking and hitting it off the planet. It's like, you know, compared to averages, I just should be hitting a little bit closer, but like, you know, I'm okay with 35 feet. Most of the time, that's just kind of what it is. But I think what happens, myself included, is, you know, you're having a good round of golf, and you know, you don't expect to get up and down all the time. But it, you know, if you play 4 par 5s and you get to them, and you don't have that club that goes that specific number, and you're expecting to make a birdie, right? In somebody's mind, they go, "Oh, I'm really missing like this number. Like I'm not able to get to the par 5s and 2, and I feel like I should." And everybody's like sucked at chipping forever, so they just assume they're going to continue to suck at chipping. You know what I mean?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I mean, so, I don't know, maybe the first or second year that I moved to Minnesota, was playing on a Thursday afternoon Chaska Town course, right? Best round I've ever shot at Chaska was 67, and I did it with 9 clubs. You just don't look at it. You don't look at it as a problem. You look at it as an opportunity.
Yeah,
it's an opportunity that, hey, choke down a little bit, hit it a little bit harder. Oh, by the way, just hit it on the green. It doesn't matter that much. You know, there are so many things that you can do. You know, there's some great stories. You know, Mac O'Grady, you know, the crazy swing guru and whatever, finished in the mid-80s. He finished like 40th on the money list over in Europe and played with a driver, 3-wood, 3-5-7-9, sand wedge, and putter.
Just didn't even carry full bag?
No, just carried that. Finished second in the British Masters with that setup.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, my buddy Frank Nobilo, you know, Frank's actually same age, same birthday. So Frank and I have gotten along for a long time. I mean, I remember walking a practice round with him sometime. He's playing with Faxon. He's got 7-iron in his hand, and he's like, oh, he hits it to the middle of the green. So he goes, I want to hit one. He goes to the caddy, goes, I want to hit one to the front of the green. Caddy goes, you want an 8-iron? He goes, no, I'll just take a little bit off a 7-iron. Okay? He goes, I want to hit one to the back of the green. You want a 6-iron? He goes, no, I'll just draw it to the back of the green. One club, and he covered 30 yards.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, if you really think about it, it's about making golf swings, and then it's about scoring.
Yeah.
You know, scoring and golf swings are two totally different things.
Yeah. You almost did my job for me bringing up how important chipping and putting is. You've been known to be a putter guru, if you will. I know a lot of people see you. I think you coached at the U a little bit for as a putting specialist, and heard you say it once, heard you say it 1,000 times. It's all about speed, right? Like speed is number one in putting. But when you're, whether it's like fitting people at second swing or like you're working with the college kids, you know, what's the main theme? What is it? Like, is it that people set up wrong? Is putters just like a complete look and feel? Because now we've got all these no torque putters, and there's broomsticks or sweepers out there. You got like the TaylorMade Spider that everybody's using. You got arm locks. You've got all these different like ways to do what feels like one of the most simplest things in golf. Like I could give my wife a putter. She doesn't play golf, but be like, hey, hit this in that hole. And she'd, you know, at least be able to give an effort.
She'd figure it out.
Yeah. You give her a driver and it's like,
Not
a chance, right? But like, there's this aspect of putting that anybody can do it, but it's also super complex and the one thing that a lot of golfers probably spend the most time on. So I want to pick your brain on it.
Well, one evening at after raiding Brad Faxon's wine cellar, my wife and I were over there at dinner, and that was about the time I started working with Lucas, and he started working with Rory. And we started talking about it. And it's like, you know, we got two guys that are kind of polar opposite players. And how do you get a tour player to go from 197th in putting down to, you know, acceptable putting?
Yeah, levels? You're trying to get him to average, right? Like, you're not trying to make him best in the world.
We're trying to get him average. And, you know,
it's like Scotty.
Fax is trying to get, you know, Rory to, you know, win majors. And, you know, you sit there and it's like, you boil it down. It's like, hey, I got to set the putter up on my intended line. I've got to get my body in a comfortable position, which is different for everybody. And then I've got to roll the ball the right speed. Okay. Within the setup in the comfortable position, is that the correct position? Is there something that's causing the stroke not to be repeatable? So you have to look at that. The next thing is, in the roll at the right speed, what's wrong with the putter? Does the putter have the wrong loft? Does it have the wrong lie? Is it the wrong length? Is it the wrong weight? Okay, is there something in the putter causing a speed issue?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how I boil it down. Okay, I had a very good junior player from Olympic Hills today. And, you know, he was like, so far over the ball that his eyes were too far forward. And I said, hey, just back up a little bit. Just get your eyes, feel like your eyes are on the inside of the ball. Starts rolling a little better. The putter starts to naturally work. You know, every golf swing's like a swinging door, okay? It starts square, club face opens, you square it, and you close it. Mm-hmm. Now, with a driver, it's a big open and close, right? With a putter, it's a very small open and close. Yeah. But you have to allow that to do it. You have to allow the head to do the job, you know? My good friend Olin Brown, you know, did a podcast with Larry Rinker, and he was talking about it, and I've heard Crenshaw say this before. Crenshaw told him, you got to give the putter head life. You know, and I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, you got to let it become the most important thing.
Well, like, let it do the work? Let is that it, what he was
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, let it do the work. Stop trying to control it. Stop having your hands try to control what happens. Just allow that thing to swing up and back. And Olin's a great putter. Absolutely great putter. And, you know, he was trying to get more information that, hey, maybe I can be even a better putter. But good putters allow that putter head. I mean, you look at, you know, the old days, you look at Crenshaw, you look at Faxon, you look at Dave Stockton. You know, now Jordan Spieth's probably the perfect example. Okay, although modern cross-handed, right? But there's a guy that allows the putter head to do the job.
Yeah.
You know, Cam Young, I remember I worked with Cam years ago at Sleepy Hollow when he was at Wake Forest. And he was putting so much side spin on the ball.
Really?
Like 77.
Ooh.
I said, Cam, I said, you can't keep taking that putter inside. So
he's just hooking him in the hole.
He hooked him in the hole, or but when he got on slower greens, that hook spin really hurt him. Now he grew up at Sleepy Hollow, where the greens are like this tabletop, so he got away with it. When he went somewhere else, that's when he struggled to putt.
Got more offline naturally. Yeah,
because you know you got that much side spin. You know the right to lefters are going to break low and short, and the other fallacy is, so if I got that much side spin, now all of a sudden the left to righters are just going to stay straight.
Yeah.
You know, he was the guy, it's like, oh, I hit it through the break. The left to right, I hit it through the break. Lucas was the same way. I hit it through the break. No, you didn't. You hooked it through the break. We got to get rid of that stuff.
There's a difference.
So I told Cam, and, you know, the really cool thing, and I don't take any credit for what he's done, but he's figured out, if you look at him putt now, the line is really tight. There's not a lot of hook spin on it at all, and the ball's rolling end to end, and the putter tends to work a little bit more square to square instead of really open to closed.
And for all the like amateurs and for the reason why Lab and Zero Torque has all come out, I mean, is that really the concept behind is like square to square? And for most people that don't have a, you know, naturally great putting stroke into out and can square it at impact, is that why so many people are succeeding with those kind of
It's an effort to stop the face rotation. It's an effort to make it feel like the putter head, you're just going to take it back and the putter head's just going to feel, it's going to feel like it stays square. Okay, it does work for a lot of people. Not necessarily for other people that have very nice natural arc with a putter that's got some toe hang to it and can release it. You know, Rocco came in one time with a couple, and he's like, he hit it. He's normally about on the Quintec, he's about 10, 12 RPMs a draw spin. Well, he draws everything. I mean, everything's a draw. So he's like, all of a sudden, this thing's like 20 RPMs a cut. He's like, what's up with that? And I go, I don't know. Maybe that was a really bad stroke, Rocco. Let's try another one. You know, he kind of gives me that look like, shut up. And he hits another one. It's like 15 RPMs. He goes, what do you think? I go, garage. So, you know, we're just putting that one in the garage. We're not going to play that. And then he goes out and he's got another one. He tries, same thing. I'm like, that's not for you.
Yeah.
You like that face to be flopping through impact. If you don't feel that, you're going to be very uncomfortable. So I mean, it's just, you have to go based on your natural tendencies, you know. And you always see, I mean, when I see a guy that comes in with, you know, a Tommy Armour old Iron Master or an 8802 style putter, whatever, and you know they got a little wear spot right in the center of the face. It's like, dude, what are you here for?
Yeah,
you know, because you can roll it, and they do, and all of a sudden numbers are great. And he goes, well, you know, maybe I thought there was something better. I'm like, okay, well, we'll look at something, maybe something that's a little more forgiving, but you can roll the rock.
Yeah,
I mean that's
clearly.
Yeah, that's clearly you're the guy that everybody looks at and goes, you're going for a putter fitting? Why are you going for a putter fitting? That yeah. doesn't make any sense. You're the best putter in our group.
Yeah, it's just that constant pursuit of perfection that you'll never achieve, which is quite frankly a reason I feel like so many of the pros go through these ebbs and flows. You know, it's like it's so hard to maybe accept that you've reached your peak or like you've reached as good as you know, you might be able to get, and yeah, there's some things you can tighten up, but it's probably not a equipment thing or a putter change. It might just be something mental wise or, you know, a change that you can just, you know, make without having to do it equipment.
I saw a great post on Facebook, and I'm not world's biggest Facebook user, but so Mickey Wright, who played back in the 60s and early 70s, and Hogan called it the best golf swing, male or female, on the planet. Okay. You got to YouTube Mickey Wright's golf swing.
Mickey Wright.
It's absolutely beautiful. And she talked about that she never tried to change her golf swing. She just tried to maintain what she had. So she felt like she was hitting the ball a little bit right. Okay, let's figure out how to close the face more. You know, maybe I'm hitting the ball left. Maybe I'm aiming. She never tried to change the golf swing based on the ball flight. She just tried to tweak it,
mm-hmm.
you know, without making this wholesale change. I think the problem sometimes is people try to make these wholesale changes that, quite frankly, if you're not hitting balls every day, 4 or 5 hours a day, you're stuck.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, Butch Harmon talked about it one time. He's like, Butch goes, yeah. He goes, you know, he was talking to PGA Club pros, and he's like, we have to tell these people that it takes time. He goes, it takes a PGA Tour player 6 months to change their backswing, to change their downswing.
That's their job. That's their full-time job.
And that's their full-time job. And he goes, you go in the grill and you see Mr. Smith, and Mr. Smith took a lesson from you 2 weeks ago, and you walk over and go, hey, how you hitting it? Ah, not very good. He goes, you know, I took that lesson, and it didn't work for two rounds, and I just decided to go back to my old swing. I didn't hit any balls in me.
The field didn't work.
Just played twice and it didn't work. I mean, you have to be willing to put the time in. You have to be willing to sit there and go, hey. Or the other thing is, I mean, you can play golf. You can score. If you can hit it solidly on the face, and I don't care whether you hit it straight, whether you draw it, whether you hit a borderline slice. You can play golf with that as long as you can do that on a consistent basis and then work on your wedge play and work on your putting. You can shoot some scores.
Yeah.
It doesn't take it's, you know, Aaron and I like always call it, it's not rocket science, because Lord knows I couldn't do it and neither could Aaron either. But it's not rocket science. It's like, hey, let's do it repetitive. You know, my great friend Dick Harmon, who is Butch's brother, who passed away far too early, was one of my best friends on the planet. And I asked him one time, we were down at his club in Houston, and I said, what's the most important thing for a good player? You know, I mean,
his dad,
Claude Harmon, won the 47 Masters, was great friends with Hogan. I'm like, what's the number one attribute of a great player? And he just looked at me without even thinking. He goes, repetition under pressure.
Mm. Yeah.
And I don't care if that, he's the one who said, I don't care if the repetition goes this way, the repetition goes that way, it goes that way. You can do that under pressure. Okay.
Yeah.
You can do that under pressure playing a $20 Nassau or playing a Friday Wind Song game
yep.
or playing in a, you know, a state open qualifier or whatever it is. It's that repetition that you know that when you hit it, it's going to be somewhere playable after the next.
It's going to do that.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and you can't really, I mean, unless you play, there's really no way to simulate or rep it. Like, you can go out and practice and you can do stuff until you're actually, I've found for me, on the golf course and the stroke actually mean something.
Right.
Like, I've been trying to be a little bit better about, you know, not hitting two off one, or, you know, when I'm actually playing, like trying to chip around the green instead of putt, because you might mentally be able to say it, but until you actually do it, then you have to write the number down on the scorecard. Like, right. Simulating a shot just isn't the same.
It's not. It's not, because first of all, you're stressed out because you maybe have a few dollars on the line. You're stressed out because maybe you're not playing that all that good. Your buddies are kind of looking at you and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, I haven't hit a good chip all day.
Yeah.
All that stuff starts playing in your head. And, you know, you just go back to, and when you play, you know, and I go back to playing mini tours back in the 80s, you know. I remember playing one time, and Dick Mast, who's still plays to this day, and Dick's probably 10 years older than I am. And, you know, I played a great round in the rain at Royal Oak by the Kennedy Space Center. I shot 5 under par, and, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, I was leading in the morning wave, and Mike Hulbert and Jeff Sluman came in. They're like, hey, nice round. Played great. I go, how am I doing out there? He goes, don't go out there. I go, what do you mean don't go out? He goes, don't go out there. He goes, Dick Mast shot 63. I'm like, son of a bitch. Really? Seriously? I'm like, okay. Hit a bad drive on a birdieable par 5 that I made par on, and I missed about a 5-footer for birdie. So I could get to 65.
Yeah, maybe get two back.
I couldn't get to 63.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember having a beer with Slu and Hubby, and they're like, man, we got to practice harder. I'm like, dude, I got to get a job. This is harder than you think, but you understand, unless you've never been there before. And I think that's one of the things that I've brought to Second Swing and brought to my fittings of, you know, average players other than tour players, is the feeling that, hey, you know, I asked some questions, you know, how do you drive? Are you comfortable? Oh, you know, had a guy today. Well, you know, oh, where do you play? I play here, here, and here. He goes, oh, I play this golf course, and I just drive it terrible there because it's tight, and I just can't keep it out of the trees. I'm like, well, then just hit your 3-1.
Yeah, hit something different. Yeah,
just hit something different. Just get the ball and play. Stop trying to be uncomfortable. If you're uncomfortable, you should never pull that club.
Yeah, you know, just a little course management and some mental stuff goes a long way.
Who's the two most conservative players in major championship history? That would be Jack Nicklaus with his 1-iron, and that would be Tiger Woods with his 2-iron. Oh, by the way, who's got the most major championship?
Those guys, all right.
That'd be those two guys, right?
Yeah.
You know, what's the difference? If I can hit it, if I'm 20 yards behind my driver, but I'm in the middle of the fairway in the short grass, I got a much more chance of hitting the ball on the green than driving it 20 yards further and I'm in the
trees.
Yeah. I was going to use a bad word, but, you know.
The shit. You can say it, Larry. It's all right.
Why should I drive it in the shit? That makes no sense. But that's how you get better. That's how you score, you know, and I think that's one of the really cool things about your podcast is – you're trying to get people to understand how to play the game, you know?
Yeah, well, it took me really a long time, and I've still got a long ways to go.
Yeah, and
to your point, it takes time.
It takes time, and I think that's a really cool thing about working for Second Swing is Second Swing is, you know, my favorite line about Second Swing is it's golfers helping golfers.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you go back in our little corner of the world with Aaron Roth and I mean there's 60 plus years of experience back there,
mm-hmm.
plus two guys that, you know, my ball doesn't go very far anymore, so it's easy to find, but, you know, he's a good player, I'm a good player, you know, you sit there and you bring some experience to people, and, you know, and that's what I tell all our fitters. I mean, you know, you're not there to tell people about your golf game, But you're also there to tell them that, hey, you know what? I play competitively. I understand, you know? You're looking for a club. You're trying to qualify for the state, AM this year, and you're struggling with your drive. Well, let's find a club for you that you can stand on the tee and put into play.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have that in your bag. Because the ego gets in the way.
Always.
Know? Yeah.
Of course it does.
Ego gets in the way of the game rather than just sitting there going, okay, you know what? I'm going to hit 3-wood. Fine. I'm going to be 40 yards behind the guys that I'm playing with. But you know what? You put a lot of pressure on those guys. If you can hit the 3-wood
on the green,
and then you hit the next shot on the green and the next shot on the green, and I'm telling you, excuse me, by the fifth or sixth hole, they're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I got to play better.
Everybody's played with that guy or gal.
This guy's killing me.
Yeah, everyone's played with that person that you know, you're ahead of them all day, and it doesn't matter. They're hitting greens or they're getting up and down from everywhere. There's a ton of ways to skin
and
a cat.
And they are making you crazy.
Yeah.
You know, they're making you look for the beverage cart.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Those are the phenomenal ball strikers, if you will. It's not just all about speed.
No, for sure. So.
Well, I got to get you to your date night. You guys are going, you're going to go to the supper club that I recommended over in Excelsior, try it out.
Absolutely. Well, you know, your next guest coming in a week or so, Dr. Hope, my wife's over there getting her back adjusted. Yeah. And so
he'll be here on Monday. I think I sent him another patient just this last week. You and I are both patients of Dr. Hope. Yeah. He's got our backs all fixed.
He's great. I mean, he's, you know, like we talked earlier, I mean, he's the one that recommended I have surgery, and, you know, it's the best thing I've ever done. I mean, this is the first time, and you know what? I hit balls. When I got released to hit balls about 3 weeks ago, Jordan, I can't tell you the last time I made a golf swing and it didn't hurt.
Pain-free, yeah.
Pain-free.
I can imagine.
It's been a long, long time, and it's fun, you know. I do have a fusion back there, so, you know, first of all, at my age, I'm not all that flexible anyway, so it, you know, it feels a little difficult, and thank God for Skechers slip-ons, so I don't have to tie a shoe.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, so, you know, but, no, you know, I love the game. I mean, my wife will tell you, she'll go, well, you know, I know you love me a lot, but your first love is golf, and she's probably right. It's just, you know, my dad introduced me to the game when I was 6 years old, and it's been everything to me.
Yeah.
The game has just been everything to me. It has taken me places that I never thought I would ever go. It's given me recognition that I thought I would never have. And it's all been in golf. It's been fun. Yeah.
You know, well, we're lucky to have you here in Minnesota, too, for anybody that's listening in local. I know it can be very hard to get on your fitting schedule. I've found out it can be hard. but if you ever go to get fit at Second Swing and Larry's name is on there, you should do whatever you can to get in there for an hour and just tap into this wonderful brain of yours with the wealth of knowledge you have, Larry. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here, plus little Buffalo Trace in.
I know. Get you warmed up for your date.
Perfect.
Yeah, you guys are going to have a great night. Appreciate you coming on, Larry.
All right.
Thank you.